You're listening to KUOW's The Record. Hi, I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining us. We're going to begin this hour by talking about something a lot of us have been discussing for the last week or so. After this week of violence and racial tensions, Sunday church services gave people a place to come together and talk about it, especially within black congregations. KUOW's race and culture reporter Liz Jones takes us inside the morning service at Mount Calvary Christian Center in Seattle's Central District.
Amen. Aren't you glad that you're in the land of the living?
Oh, yes. Hallelujah.
Yeah, you hear what I'm saying? Aren't you glad?
This simple message and the music pulled everyone to their feet, and people offered up thanks just to be alive and to be together in this church at 23rd and Union in Seattle's historically black neighborhood.
How awesome he is. Hallelujah. We bless you, Lord.
As the song played out, the 100 or so people swayed together. An elderly black woman shook hands with a white man who'd just come in the door. A mother hugged her teenage son close. A logjam of tears and emotion flowed freely, and it was loud.
We thank you, we thank you, we thank you!
In time, Pastor Reggie Witherspoon took the pulpit.
I want to talk from this subject, doing right when you've been wronged.
Witherspoon grew up in this neighborhood. He's not one to shy away from controversy. He took heat years ago for a position against same-sex marriage. But on this day, his message focused on one thing, how to bring people together to fight racism.
This is a very unsettling time in America. I mean, you need to wake up and be honest with that. America is going in the wrong direction.
He said violence is never the answer, not from police and not against them. He pulled out some lyrics from Marvin Gaye to make his point on a lighter note.
Don't punish me with brutality. Come on, somebody. Come on, talk to me so we can see what's going on.
Specifically, what's going on around racism and gun violence. Witherspoon urged people to take action on those two fronts. He suggested people call their lawmakers and demand changes around gun control and police accountability, and for everyone to keep up the conversation on race.
I've got a lot of white pastors, and they would ask me, man, what can I do about all these racial issues? I say, you got to get up in your pulpit and address it.
The service ends with a prayer.
God, would you please help us to not have to grieve any more tragedy?
Rachel Cox and her husband were among the few white people at Mount Calvary. Their bus driver invited them, and this was their first visit. Cox said the service helped her think about efforts she can make in her own life.
Raising our children with people that are different than us is super important, and that's an action I can take. I think just us immersing ourselves in different cultures in our own city is an action I can take.
Church member Rico Golden appreciated that idea.
That definitely will help, because in all reality, you know, it is kind of like in the black community, we feel that white people tend to not accept us for who we are.
He says this past year and week has raised his fear for his own life as a young black man.
It was maybe a moderate level. Now it's a high level. Now it's an extreme level.
25-year-old Tiara Atkins says she can relate.
It really broke my heart. I think after I watched so many videos, I was really crying because I thought about, you know, what if this happened to my brothers? And my brothers are my world. And so I can't imagine that.
Atkins wants to see a safer world for her brothers and other young people. She plans to be a high school teacher someday. But for now, she's just working out a message for her white friends. It boils down to this. We need your support, and we need it now. In Seattle's Central District, I'm Liz Jones, KUOW News.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. So far, we've been talking about police and violence, and now we're going to turn to Seattle's ongoing issue of rising prices. We've been showing you who gets affected by the rising cost of a home in this city, and now KUOW's Ruby DeLuna has this story of one Seattle baby boomer.
It's Wednesday morning. Bill Totten is checking in at the Hygiene Center in Seattle's Pioneer Square. He hands his laundry card to the staff.
Thank you, dear.
You all do laundry and shower?
No shower, just laundry.
Once he's signed in, Totten puts his clothes on a scale to weigh them before they go in the washer.
Now we get to see if we made the magic 15 pounds. It's like the county fair. I did. I'm 3 pounds under. I am so good.
Another staff person directs Totten to a machine that's open. He loads the washer.
You drop your clothes off, and then by the end of the day, you have to pick them up.
Bill Totten is 61 years old and on disability. He's been homeless since May. He spends his nights at a shelter for homeless men over 50. Before that, Totten was renting a room in the basement of a house that was in disrepair, a crumbling foundation, no heat.
I was paying $650 plus $100 for utilities, and here's the deal, the basement, there was an illegal subdivide.
The landlord was also renting out to other people beyond the house's capacity. The building was unsafe on another level. One of the tenants assaulted him over an electric bill.
I was really tapped out. I was glad to have a place. I thought maybe it was just an aberration at that one time. And then it happened again.
Things got complicated. The landlord tried to evict him twice. The landlord wanted a new rental agreement. Totten withheld rent because the unit was in bad shape. Totten said the situation was wearing him down, so he got out. Seattle's housing market is not only pricing renters out, it's also causing people like Totten to live in substandard conditions because it's what they can afford. Older adults may be vulnerable to offers of illegal housing. Some landlords have rented out garages as homes.
We've seen that. We've seen sheds.
Rory O'Sullivan is senior managing attorney for the Housing Justice Project. The legal clinic helps low-income folks facing eviction. O'Sullivan says more tenants have been seeking help in the last 4 years, including people over 60.
This year, the increase has been even more dramatic.
In previous years, seniors make up about 13% of the legal clinic's caseload. Now, it's closer to 20%. Other organizations that work with renters also report a spike in complaints. O'Sullivan says in Seattle, landlords must give tenants 2 months' notice if they're going to raise the rent by more than 10%. Tenants, especially older ones, can protect themselves, first by knowing their rights as early as possible. The lease is a good place to start. It spells out the obligations of landlords and renters when it comes to things like repairs, security deposit, and maintenance.
Try to document everything. Make sure you get a receipt every time you pay rent. When you make a repair request, make sure that it's in writing and that you have a record of it. But we see these issues every day, and the tenants who are able to negotiate a good outcome are the tenants who have read their lease and documented their communications with the landlord.
Thank you.
Back at the hygiene center, Bill Totten's laundry is done. He spends his days walking or online looking for work to supplement his Social Security. Some days, he likes to take a break from it all.
Once in a while, I'll do something, just like go up to the main office of my bank, Wells Fargo, and, oh, Mr. Totten, how are you? Have a dum-dum. And, you know, I don't feel like I'm walking around with the Orange Harborview bag on 3rd Avenue.
It helps keep his sense of humor in perspective. He has stored his belongings at a friend's house while he looks for a permanent home, but the options for someone on Social Security are limited. He has about $1,700 a month to work with.
And then that has to keep my medical co-payments, my prescription co-payments, my bus pass, any incidentals.
Totten says he might have to consider other cities like Everett or Tacoma, though he hears the average rents there are going up too. And in his heart, Seattle is home.
My city's my family.
He's been working with a social worker to get connected to services and keeping his ears open for leads. I'm Ruby DeLuna, KUOW News.
Now, one reason Seattle home prices rise is that we have a humming economy. We've got high-paying fields like biotech here, and that is our next topic today. You may have heard of targeted immunotherapy, where biotech scientists take your T cells and re-engineer them to attack and maybe eradicate cancer. It is a very promising frontier, and until recently, a local company called Juno Therapeutics has been a rising star. Now, though, the FDA has put one of Juno's clinical trials on hold, and the company's stock has plunged. This comes after 3 cancer patients enrolled in a Juno clinical trial died. Now, it's not unusual for people who are sick with cancer to die in the course of a clinical trial, but biotech journalist Luke Timmerman says it's the way those patients died that was unusual.
3 patients in a clinical trial for Juno Therapeutics died of a cerebral edema, and that is swelling of the brain. And that is not normally the sort of thing that people die from when they have this particular form of cancer, acute lymphoblastic leukemia. So this was considered related to the treatment, and that's a major red flag and the sort of thing that makes regulators and researchers want to put the brakes on and stop an ongoing trial to see what's wrong.
Okay, so when we talk about a red flag and regulators, are you saying, is there evidence that that there was some kind of malfeasance here? Because people do die in clinical trials.
No, there's no suggestion of that. Yes, these patients are gravely ill with cancer, and there's grim statistics. Like, we expect them to live only a few months. So the real question is, are they dying of the cancer, or are they dying of something related to a drug side effect?
Okay, let's say more about that. First of all, what is the clinical trial is for what? What's the Juno drug?
The drug is actually called JCAR15, and that CAR part is important. That's a short acronym for chimeric antigen receptor modified T cells. That's a mouthful, but what they do is they engineer T cells of your immune system to recognize a specific marker on the cancer cells. It's like waving a red flag that says this is what the immune cells should attack. And they have gotten very encouraging results so far, completely eradicating tumors in very ill patients, in a large number of these very ill patients. But this is also a very powerful form of therapy, and it comes with side effects. And so just to take a step back. When patients go in for this kind of cell therapy, they get chemotherapy first to wipe out a lot of their existing T cells to create a more favorable environment for the re-engineered T cells to come in and graft and start attacking the cancer. What Juno did, they had some success with a single chemo preconditioning agent. They added a second one. And it's those patients who got the second one who had these severe reactions.
Do we know how much excitement there was about this experimental therapy? In other words, if I'm listening, is this a major letdown for beyond Juno for the community of people who have or might get cancer?
Yes. So this whole field of CAR T immunotherapy, these engineered T cells, it's one of the biggest ideas in all of cancer research today. There are very exciting results from these gravely ill patients having their cancer eradicated. And not just for Juno, but for a couple of other companies as well. And so, but Juno is a leader in this field, and its stock has soared on a lot of this excitement and anticipation that they've got something really big for cancer. So when they encounter a problem of this magnitude, it does raise questions, not just about Juno, but other companies and really this whole field. That are there things that we don't know yet about how these cells are working that maybe we need to figure out before going full steam ahead?
Meanwhile, we're talking about companies and investors and, you know, but really what this is about is human beings and sickness and health and death and life.
Yeah, so we had more than 20 people enroll in this clinical trial, and all of them have a very grim prognosis. They don't have a lot of other options. So they're taking a chance, and this is still an early stage developmental therapy, and there are a lot of risks that go with that, and they are informed of that. Obviously, nobody likes to see patients die in a clinical trial from side effects. The goal is to extend their life longer than it otherwise would be with the horrible disease they have. But this also is how we learn. So it could be that these patients, they died and we learn something about the preconditioning regimen that will help others who come later. You know, I know that's small consolation for the family members, for the patients, for everybody involved, but that is the nature of how clinical trials work.
Biotech reporter Luke Timmerman is the founder of the Timmerman Report, a newsletter about the industry, and he co-hosts a podcast about how your medicines get made. It's called Signal, and we're tweeting out a link to it right now. We are at KUOW. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9, Seattle News and Information. Simple steps could have prevented last month's fiery derailment of an oil train in the Columbia River Gorge if inspectors from Union Pacific Railroad or government regulators had just walked that stretch of track in the weeks or months prior. They might have spotted broken bolts, but nobody did. Reporter Tony Schick of our EarthFix team says those missed bolts in Mosier exposed the flaws in our railroad inspection system.
On April 27th, Steve Holm and three other inspectors drove right over a set of broken railroad bolts that later caused a massive oil train explosion. Holm rode shotgun as Union Pacific's custom pickup truck rolled over the tracks at 10 miles an hour.
I went from the Dalles to Cascade Locks that day.
Holm is a track inspector with the Oregon Department of Transportation. He stared out the front windshield at the steel rails, the wood ties beneath, and the plates and bolts that held them together.
Yeah, it was a normal inspection. There's nothing outstanding that stood out in my mind about it.
Holm suspects several of the lag bolts fastening the rail lines to the ties had been sheared and rusted over for some time. But he missed them. Union Pacific says it followed federal laws, meaning in the 5 weeks that followed, its own inspectors would have ridden over those bolts at least 10 more times. Then, on the afternoon of June 3rd, those bolts failed under the weight of a mile-long train hauling Bakken crude oil. The rail spread apart, and the train left the tracks.
When I got up there and I saw what had happened, I was very surprised.
As Mosher shows, potentially dangerous rail defects can go unaddressed for months. Yet railroads and government regulators all say the current rules are adequate. The minimum federal requirements allow railroads considerable leeway for how they inspect their own track. Government checks are few and far between.
Now, should that give you any pause about whether the inspection system, the inspection regime, is itself designed to be really rigorous and really work or not? I mean, the fact is, it doesn't pick up all the defects.
That's Fred Millar, an independent consultant in hazardous materials transport. He's been critical of a proposal for the country's largest oil-by-rail terminal in Vancouver. Sarah Feinberg, the head of the Federal Railroad Administration, told OPB in June that her agency is considering enforcement action against the railroad.
When it comes down to it, it's Union Pacific's failure to maintain its track led to this incident.
While Union Pacific is to blame, the railroad isn't alone. In its initial report on Mosier, the FRA says broken lag bolts are more effectively caught if inspections are done by walking on the tracks instead of driving. But the FRA doesn't require it, so Union Pacific didn't do it. Before the derailment, the FRA's own inspectors hadn't laid eyes on the tracks in Mosier or reviewed the railroad's inspection records from the gorge since early this year. A spokesman for Union Pacific said the company surpassed the bare minimums for inspection frequencies in the gorge. That means visual inspections at least twice a week. The FRA's Feinberg encourages and even expects railroads to exceed her agency's requirements to ensure track safety.
Those are minimum regulations. As with any safety regulation, you can always go above and beyond, and it's the responsibility of the railroad to do the maintenance that's needed to make sure that the section of track is safe.
Despite this latest oil train explosion, FRA data show overall derailments are on the decline and have been for years. The railroad industry says that more than 99% of hazardous material shipments reached their destination safely. That slim failure rate has included more than 24 crude-by-rail incidents in recent years. Bad track has caused the majority of them. Experts say the weight and movement of oil trains puts a new burden on the nation's rail infrastructure. Mike Elliott is a Seattle train engineer and a former union safety official.
They are self-regulated to a degree. The regulations that are in place, the federal regulations, they're the bare minimum.
State agencies in Oregon and Washington together have 5 track inspectors. That means ODOT's Steve Holm and 4 others are responsible for more than 5,000 miles of track.
Generally, I'll check in on the railroads, like, say, every 8 to 9 months.
The FRA has only 10 track inspectors, covering thousands of miles in 8 western states, all the way from the Dakotas, through Oregon and Washington, and up to Alaska. I'm Tony Schick, reporting.
And that story was co-reported with Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson. Now on the record, we're going to talk about something you probably appreciate about the Pacific Northwest, green space. In West Seattle, there are 33 undeveloped acres, the biggest piece of undeveloped land in the city of Seattle. It's called the Myers Parcel. Right now, that parcel is owned by Seattle taxpayers. It's the last place in the city where a new big public park could go. But the parcel is up for sale to developers, meaning that acreage could become more housing. Reporter Adiel Kaplan with Investigate West says as Seattle grows, the city is balancing competing priorities, housing and accessible green space.
It really is the last chance to take a large piece of completely undeveloped land in the city and maintain it that way. There's a ton of animals that live there. It's got a thriving ecosystem, and it's also in a part of town that is not one of the more the richer areas of town. There's a lot of social justice work going on over there just on the edge of the parcels. I think to the west side is the Greenbridge Affordable Housing Development, and so there's a lot of places that could, a lot of ways that this would benefit the local community.
A decade ago, the city set a goal of 1 acre of green space for every 100 residents, and now they say that's just not going to happen. Why is that?
Well, we grew a lot. I think we added about 70,000 people in the last 10 years, and we're projected to add another 120 over the next 20. And those people have to go somewhere, and the goal of 1 acre per 100 people gets a lot less realistic when you're not expanding your boundaries and you are adding, you know, 200,000 people. And I don't think they anticipated that.
The city at one point wanted to have 1 acre of green space for every 100 residents. We've grown a lot, so that's not realistic now. But you'd expect that, right? We grow. I mean, is that a big loss that we can't have an acre of green space per 100?
For a city that's called the Emerald City, probably. But at the same time, the Parks Department is prioritizing making parks more accessible. So the parks we do have, they want to improve walkability to those parks and find more ways of creating public community spaces, even if they're not necessarily going to be new grassy and tree-covered areas.
Are you talking about pavement parks?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You also get into this in your article. Pavement parks, would you say not really a park?
They're definitely a park. There's a park. They're parked the same way that any sort of public square is a park, and they add a lot to the community. They add value. They create gathering spaces.
Well, think Westlake Park would be an example, right?
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time,
a little used area that can be set aside with some chairs or some activities, even if it's not green.
And that's exactly the idea. The park we talk about in the article is the First Hill Pavement Park, and that's actually an intersection that wasn't being used at the corner of Union University in Boylston, and it just was this awkward, odd-shaped triangle that didn't have a lot of traffic, and it was kind of confusing who had the right-of-way anyways. So they blocked it off with some cement planters, painted the pavement bright blue, and set up a bunch of tables and chairs. And you can see people there fairly regularly.
But you're saying that's not enough?
Well, there's certainly not any grass or trees that are growing in there.
Well, let's talk about grass and trees and green, because the city has a new 20-year comprehensive plan for growth. What does it say about green spaces?
It doesn't particularly mention green space so much as open space. And we're seeing an expansion of the definition of open space, which may at one point have just meant traditional green space, park space, to emphasize more these creative solutions such as pavement parks or parklets, which they call these little kind of wooden areas that you can put in a parking space that create seating near restaurants and things like that, and a few other similar solutions to be included in what open space is.
The big picture here is that in so many ways, Adiel, we're trying to deal with growth and density. And in you're arguing what? How do you think Seattle is handling that growth with the need to breathe a little?
Well, That is the conversation that we have going on. You're absolutely right. And green space is just one aspect of it. But it's a particular aspect that's important because we can't backtrack on this one. If we lose the green space to developers, you're not going to undevelop the land. That's not how the economics of development work. It's sort of a, if we lose it now, we can't get it back later kind of thing.
So you can see the logic, though, right? The city can make money by selling off some land and use that money to maintain other parks, or I don't know if it could even go in the general fund for, we have all kinds of needs in the city.
Well, right now it's supposed to go to the general fund. The money has been earmarked to go fight the homelessness crisis, or at least half of the money has, and the rest will probably be folded into the general fund. But as for maintaining parks, we have the Parks District levy from 2014 for that. And that was mostly focused on park maintenance. It's about 47, I believe, million a year, and 2 million of that go to acquisitions. But the Myers parcels is 33 acres for less than $2 million that would be, you may not make a lot of money on that, but you're preserving a part of Seattle that will otherwise just get developed.
How do we compare with other cities our size when it comes to green spaces?
We're doing good. We're in the top, 10 or so cities when you're looking at a lot of different environmental and sustainability factors, and we want to stay there. We have this this track record and this claim to fame. We love our parks. We're the Emerald City. I mean, that's such an important part of the city's identity, and it's something that may be a bit of a challenge to hold on to as we deal with increasing density and growth.
Adiel Kaplan is a reporter with Investigate West, and we've been talking there about the Myers parcel in West Seattle, but then the bigger issues of parks and green space, pavement parks in this city. She wrote about this, and we're tweeting out a link to that article right now at KUOW. Thanks for tuning in today to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I think it's fair to say we have issues about gender identity and expression in this country. A couple of examples. Right now, 10 states are suing the Obama administration over the president's directive that transgender people should be allowed to use public bathrooms that align with their gender identity. Last year, a mom wrote a blog post complaining about the girls' t-shirts and shorts that were cut to fit snugly and tightly, while the boys' clothes were not. And the post went viral, and Target ended up partnering with that mom to work on changing their girls' clothes. Well, comedian and writer Jesse Klein has spent a lot of time thinking about how she wanted to be a girl and how other people expected her to be a girl. And she wrote about that in her memoir called You'll Grow Out of It.
Yeah, it's so weird to just be like, I am a girl. It sounds like, when they talk about aliens having to imitate a person, like, I am a girl person.
Yes.
And was born one, still am one. And yet it felt very uncomfortable and difficult for a lot of it. I was definitely a tomboy growing up, and I just generally feel more comfortable. I don't know. I don't want to say not being girly, because anything that I do should sort of inherently be girly because I'm a girl, and yet there is what is kind of the acceptable standard of girliness. And I'm sure men, the standard of what masculine is, I think in some ways is as suffocating, if maybe just a little more physically forgiving.
You use the word tomboy. Do they still say tomboy? That's probably what we would have called you when I was a kid.
I guess people are still being called tomboys. Obviously, and I think in a good way, there's more recognition now of, people's sexual identities falling on a spectrum and people's gender identities falling on a spectrum. But I believe that a tomboy, in the sense that I'm using it, is probably still a thing, in the sense of a young, presumably straight girl who just is rejecting having to do all the stuff. The way I didn't want to do all that stuff.
From early on?
From very early on, yeah.
Tell me about that. What do you first remember about feeling that way?
I just never wanted to wear a skirt or a dress. I just was like, but why would I do that? That seems real dumb. Yeah, I just kind of, all of the stuff of makeup and hair and, I don't know, it just, none of it appealed to me.
So as you're growing up, you're not dressed in girly. Halloween rolls around, age 10, and Jesse Klein is?
Oh, yeah, it was Groucho Marx.
Groucho Marx. And that was, I mean, I'm just picturing the roominess, the bagginess, not to mention the manniness of the Groucho Marx. That just seems like a lot of you. I picture you dressed that way all growing up.
Different. I mean, yeah, the costume didn't require a huge stretch.
Right.
It was really one. If you knew me, you might not have even known I was dressed for Halloween. Yeah, I was wearing baggy pants and I think a blazer that belonged to my dad. And I did buy the mustache and the glasses. I wore a lot of my dad's old shirts. So that should tell you something about where I was at.
Is there even a possible answer to the question why?
I mean, gosh, why? I think growing up, you know, I didn't have a mother who was modeling that type of behavior for me. But I suppose it was all around me anyway. It just wasn't me.
You had an inner voice in your head and it was a dude.
Yeah, my inner voice was like a totes dude. Yeah, I think it just seemed like the voice of a narrator, the idea of like someone telling a story, the way as we walk through our day, we're kind of constantly talking to ourselves and telling the story to ourselves of what is happening. And it seemed like a storyteller was a guy. That's like the most, I guess, sort of Freudianish way that I can put it. And I just didn't hear a feminine pitched voice in my head. I'm trying to think even now if I guess I feel the same way. I just hear a voice. I guess it's more genderless than anything.
Can you do the voice?
What's up? No, I don't know. It's it just was up. It just didn't, you know, it wasn't like, so, wow, what am I going to do now? I don't know. I mean, that's horrible too. But I guess it was just the sense that self-determination and narrating were male things.
So how did that play out as you grew up? What happened to the tomboy?
I was very tomboyish, I think, until, you know, I dated my college boyfriend. And then, you know, we kind of broke up at the time in life when a lot of my friends or just people start to get married. I suddenly became single for the first time and I didn't know how to do it. And I think all of a sudden, I felt like maybe it was time to renovate the house and start to, you know, I was like, maybe it's necessary to kind of get it together a little bit in terms of working on my feminine wiles or what have you. And that's when I probably bought some skirts and some dresses and and it wasn't all just me bending. It was also internally directed too. I was like, I think I'd like to try to look more stereotypically like a girl who would like to have a boyfriend. And so that's probably in my late 20s, I kind of gave up like the backpack because my best friend, I met her at a bar one evening and I had my backpack and I set it down on the floor. Yeah. And my friend, in the very loving way that only your most loving friends will say, she said, "Jesse, your backpack is hurting my feelings." And that was when I was like, oh yeah, maybe it's time to lose the backpack.
You know, the funny thing is a lot of people have a problem with gender ambiguity, but everybody loves a tomboy. Early on, at least, it's very charming.
Oh, yeah. It's adorable.
What's that about?
Well, I don't know. I guess the closest I could come to saying what it's about is kids are pre-puberty. And so seeing a little girl kind of running around in her overalls, what have you, it feels sort of acceptable and unthreatening. And then post-puberty, when a woman's sexuality, not to get all Vassar College about it, but when a woman's sexuality is sort of when there's this new standard of what is understood and what is expected, I think women who don't look like that, you know, it can make people angry.
As you say, nobody likes a tom man.
I mean, nobody likes a tom man. I think that's true.
We've been talking about this issue of what gender even means. And as you said, we all react to this in some way. So I wonder, have you come up with your own take on what gender even means to you?
Gosh, I don't know that I have my own take. You know, what's important to me is I'm kind of in the camp of like, I just want everybody to be happy. I want everybody to do what feels right for them.
Jessie Klein is a comedian and a writer, and her book is called You'll Grow Out of It. Here in Washington, that initiative that would have limited trans people's ability to use public bathrooms that aligned with their gender identity, that missed its signature deadline last week. So that's not happening for now. We're tweeting out a link to a recent interview we did with the Gender Justice League director, Danny Aschini. She talked about how she is sick of arguing about bathroom use for trans people. We'll send that out to you at KUOW. You're tuned to The Record. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thankfully, there's Todd Bishop from the Seattle tech news site GeekWire. You're going to carry me on this one, Todd.
I am, and there's a Pokemon right over your shoulder.
Is there?
Bill, right? Yes.
Hey, I'm just of the age to have sort of missed. I know what Pokemon is, and I know it's from Nintendo, and Nintendo of America is here in Redmond. But suddenly I'm hearing about Pokemon again. Wasn't that a 90s thing?
It was, but suddenly it's 2016. Pokemon Go came out last week. Really became a surprise hit in just a few days. This is a new mobile app. It is augmented reality, so it places on top of the real world through your smartphone Pokemon and allows you to capture them and do all sorts of fun things with gyms and all sorts of interesting things that you can do with your friends.
Wait, augmented reality meaning
yes.
Goggles?
No, it's augmented reality through the screen of your smartphone.
Okay.
So you can
hold it up in front of you?
Exactly, and you can see on the real world characters and Pokemon. And so this is essentially taking the world by storm in many ways. And it is so successful so far in terms of the number of downloads. It's on more than 5% of the Android devices out there. It's the top selling, top downloaded iPhone game so far over the past week. And Nintendo stock is up 25% today.
25%.
This is a company that has made a huge bet on its own devices, the Nintendo 3DS, the Wii U console, and they were so strong in holding out, not going to smartphones. And here they finally did it after years of waiting. This is the first real game that they put on a smartphone, and it is just taking off.
Okay, two things that sound like no-brainers to me.
Yes.
Doing a game on a smartphone and doing a sequel or some update
yes.
to Pokemon. So why isn't this, I don't understand, why isn't this obvious? What's the difference between a fail and a hit?
Well,
Any thoughts?
So Nintendo has been stubborn about this over the years. They saw success, obviously, for decades with their home consoles, and it just took them a while to get used to the idea of doing it on a smartphone. And the Nintendo franchises have such cult followings that you're seeing that then mesh with the portability and the accessibility of a smartphone app. And on top of that, you've got the twist here of this makes you get out into the real world. There was a bit of a trending topic over the weekend where all of these video gamers were complaining about their sore legs. You know, they've been out cycling and running around with their friends all weekend. So it actually breaks some of the stereotypes about games. So very hard to find negative things here, although there are questions about the data that the app is collecting from your phone that are just starting to bubble up. So that's something we'll be tracking.
Pokemon data collection.
Exactly.
Okay, I read somebody say Pokemon Go fulfills a fantasy Pokemon fans have had since the games first came out. What if Pokemon were real and inhabited our world?
Absolutely. Now, just imagine if they did this with Mario.
Oh, my gosh.
It would just, the world might just end.
It might tip
yes.
a little bit,
I mean,
the
you,
Axis thing.
You thought Brexit was a
yeah.
big deal?
Yeah. Hey, finally, I don't know how big a deal this is. I know what Amazon's Dash button is,
yes.
but I've been hearing that, and you've been reporting that they're expanding the Dash to more stuff in your home. What's the deal?
That's right. Dash, the idea is you set it up, you press a button, it reorders common household items. Just recently, Amazon expanded this to toys from Hasbro, Nerf, and Play-Doh, and I'm holding in my hand right now a Play-Doh Dash button. I just pressed it 10 times. I'll be getting 200 24 packs
yeah.
of Play-Doh to my house. No, that's not actually
quite.
Not true. They build in safeguards, but this
you
is
stick it on to household items. I know they did it with detergent and soup
exactly.
and things, and now it's toys.
Someday you will have a direct mental connection to the Amazon warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be telepathy. In the meantime, there is the Amazon Dash button.
So it just orders it. It's on the way.
It is.
Little things. Can they not raise the price on the item without my knowing it? I thought that was the deal. You price shopped.
So you can set it up in advance, and there are safeguards. So, for example, if you order multiple items and you didn't mean to, you can cancel them on your phone. So you can review the order on your smartphone before it actually goes through.
But how do I know I'm getting a good deal? I can't price shop if I just push a button and
exactly
hope for the best. Exactly, Bill. You're on to it. Okay, fine. Another thing. I have a printer that tells Hewlett-Packard when I'm low on ink.
Yes.
But why can't any company bypass Amazon and have me directly order from them?
They can. And Amazon, though, is trying to get in the middle of that, too, with what they call the Dash Replenishment Program, which puts sensors into those devices, just like you're talking about, that automatically reorders from Amazon in exactly the same way.
Right. So theoretically, anybody could do it, but Amazon wants to own so much of the infrastructure to make that happen that they're the default.
And they now have more than 60 million Prime members in the U.S., so there is a huge advantage to them because they have the direct connection to the customer that HP may not.
Okay, does this make it too easy to spend money? That's the knock, right?
It does. The Dash button feels like an intermediary step to me, a bit of a novelty. But that said, I think it points to the direction of where online retail is going.
Todd Bishop with GeekWire, the tech news website. It's great to have you on all the time explaining tech stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
On KUOW's The Record, we're tweeting at KUOW. We're on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. Thank you for tuning in today.